From Small Data Industries, this is Art and Obsolescence. I'm your host, Cass Fina-Radin, and on this show, I chat with people that are shaping the past, present, and future of art and technology. And I know what you're thinking, but Cass, it's not the first Tuesday of the month. What are you doing in my podcast feed? And also, where have you been? Well, dear listeners, I have to apologize, as I have definitely become a little lax about release schedules, but it's for a very good reason. Not only are there just some really, really exciting projects in Small Data's lab right now that I had to prioritize, but also you may recall me sharing a while back that I was going to spend some time thinking about creative new ideas for the show's future, and I can't share too much right now because it's still very early days, but I am talking to a potential partner organization to serve as a home for the show, and there's some really cool creative ideas for expanding the show creatively and making it bigger and better, but most importantly, making it sustainable. So more soon on this front, I hope. Now, in the meantime, we are continuing with our special series in collaboration with Voca, presenting my interviews with artists and co-founders of The Dirt Palace, a feminist artist-run space and residency program in Providence, Rhode Island, that has served as an incubator for hundreds of artists. Last episode, we chatted with Xander Marrow, and today we are visiting with Pippi Zornoza. Now, if you didn't catch the last episode, I recommend jumping back and listening to the intro for that one, as I shared a whole kind of like really deeply personal context for this project of interviewing Xander and Pippi and how I came to know them years ago. Also, if you didn't catch the last episode, just a heads up that this episode will sound quite different from what you are used to. It was recorded on different mics and on location, but most importantly, this was edited for video first. So if you are so inclined, you can head on over to Voca's website. I'll put the link in the show notes, and you can watch this interview on video, which is a first for us. And if you truly cannot wait to hear the final conversation with both Xander and Pippi, all three interviews are up on Voca's website to watch as video. And in fact, I highly recommend checking out the video for this interview in particular for when Pippi shows us her axe. And no, I'm not talking about a guitar. I'm talking about a literal axe. And no, I am not going to give you any more context than that. I was so excited for this conversation with Pippi. Just like Xander, her work is incredibly interdisciplinary, and it really defies any hard boundaries, not only of media, but also of contexts. As you'll hear, Pippi's artwork often involves performance and sound, not just as works of art in that sort of gallery context, but also as a musician. I'm sure Pippi will cringe if she hears me say this, but Pippi is sort of a legend of Providence's underground music scene. Back when I first got to know her, she was playing in a band called Bone Dust, and I remember just how viscerally powerful and intense she was as a drummer. She's been in countless other bands, including Throne of Blood, Sawzall, Vulture, Retrix, and currently a band called Harpy with her collaborator Gina Bootleg. And there's probably about 50 other bands or collaborations that she's been involved in that I don't know about. And I thought, rather than try and describe Pippi's music to you or assign genres to it, why don't we just listen to it? So we're going to start this episode with a little listening party. We're going to listen to a track called A Sacrifice from Harpy's album of the same title. And from there, we'll lead right into the interview. Now, if you enjoy the music, definitely check out the show notes. There's a link to Harpy's Bandcamp where you can pick up the album, as well as a link to Pippi's Bandcamp, which is full of various other projects from past years. So without further delay, let's dive in and listen to A Sacrifice by Harpy.
Yeah.
So we're here at the Dirt Palace with Pippi Zornoza, co-founder of the Dirt Palace. And Pippi, thank you so much for joining me today for this conversation with Voca.
Thanks for having me, of course.
Yeah. So I said the same thing to Xander. One of the reasons I love doing these artist interviews is it's an opportunity to sit down with an artist who I know and I feel like I know well, but I know that there are definitely like holes and gaps in your story that I just don't know even myself already. So I'm curious for you, part of that is your origin story, you know, so I'm curious, you know, where did you grow up and just what kind of creativity were you being exposed to and where did things really begin for you?
Yeah, I'm not sure my origin story is super interesting. I mean, my mother grew up in Toledo, Ohio, and my father is from Madrid in Spain. And my mom actually was, she studied French and was teaching English in France and then was teaching English to children on a military base in Spain. And then I think realized she didn't want to teach children anymore and started teaching adults. And that's how she met my father. So it feels like a very unusual meeting. I don't know. It's weird to talk about them first, but I think of them as like both people who grew up in the 50s and 60s who were part of these very large extended families, but were the only people who left where they were from to go somewhere else. My mom left Ohio and my dad left Spain to come to the States. And when I was growing up, you know, my father's not a citizen. There wasn't a lot of emphasis on art. It really wasn't like part of my upbringing. I don't think either of my parents like have a lot of knowledge about art. I mean, they definitely, especially now, like appreciate it. I think I was just a child who could draw very realistically. And so I was encouraged as if I was an artist from a very young age because of that skill, which is actually kind of really sad to me because I just feel like there's so many ways of making art and so many kids kind of get left behind in that concept of what art making is. But I think I was just really fortunate in having that very particular skill. And so was encouraged that I was artistic because but I think that I really didn't have much exposure to any contemporary art. And that really happened later when I ended up going to art school. So I really feel like I came to RISD as someone who like really didn't have the background or understanding of contemporary art the way like maybe other people that I went to school with. Yeah. So my mind was blown.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I had a very similar experience when I got to art school. Hearing that those 4 years must have been, just very eye-opening for you in terms of just exposure to new things and art and music. So I'm curious, what were you making during those years and how did your creativity evolve as you eventually left art school?
Yeah, I think I just wanted to try everything. But then at some point, maybe when I went into the sculpture department originally. And then at some point I was just really young and just art felt so insignificant to me at the time in this way, or I don't know if it was just a self-consciousness, but I just felt like thinking about making art became like, almost like, I don't know. I actually dropped out of school, some time. I just felt like I couldn't connect to fine art in a way, like just something got in the way. And I ended up working in a pizza place for the year, delivering pizza, Checkers. I don't know if you remember Checkers. It's like a very mythological pizza place in Providence. Yeah. Delivered pizzas there for some time. And then, which was a really weird, interesting experience because all my roommates were still in school. So I would come home at like 2 a.m. and they would all be asleep already taking classes. And so it was kind of very isolated at that time. But there was like one night where I had this idea of a quilt that I wanted to make. And I think that's what made me go back to school was this like idea of an actual object that I wanted to make. And I wasn't even thinking of it really totally as an art object. But from there, because I had wanted to make this, I ended up going into the printmaking department so I could learn how to screen print the fabric, learn how to quilt, and start in making that quilt that I really wanted to make. And from there, while I was in school, I actually made a lot of utilitarian objects. And mostly textile based. So was doing a lot of embroidery and quilting and making blankets and quilts. And then from printmaking really started segueing into making posters. But I needed at that time and where I was at in my thought process, I needed utility to almost learn the craft and get past, needed the function of an object to even be able to access art making, because it was just something I was really going through and struggling with at the time. But I do think that something that has stayed with me through that time period is that I do think a lot about context and like where my art is and like what the context is of it. And I generally do prefer for the work to exist in everyday spaces over gallery spaces, whether that's like on the street as in public art, or thinking about a space that people go to all the time that's not necessarily like a gallery or museum, which is something that I'm like now coming back to another part of what I've been really considering is I've started making these works now that feel quite haunted. And I'm sort of like, what is the right context for these? And that's something that's been, I've been thinking about a lot.
It seems almost happenstance or luck that you happened to be at RISD, because you sounds like have had a bit of this existential crisis with art and like, what is its function? What role does it serve in people's lives? And you just happened to be at a school with an incredible amount of craft. So it sounds like that for you removed the pretense of like, what role does this serve?
Thing. And the other thing was, I was just like, I have my whole life to be an artist. Like, I'm in school. I don't need, like, it wasn't that I wasn't wanting to think about ideas or the concepts at all. Of course I was, but I just felt like if I'm paying all this money, I should be getting a tangible skill here. And I felt like that's what I felt like from printmaking was, I was like, this is something that I couldn't learn anywhere else that I will carry with me. And plus Providence just has such an amazing culture of screen printing, that I was also really blown away by what I was seeing around and seeing on the streets. So it felt like quite a natural fit, even though I was coming at it originally from like a textile point of view.
So speaking about what you were seeing around and seeing on the streets, and I'm imagining some of these were show posters for, you know, concerts at semi-legal or completely underground, you know, venues and warehouses. I know that sometimes there can be a bit of a barrier between, you know, the east side where the colleges are and other parts of the city where, you know, artists who just live here live and work and musicians live and work. So I guess for you, what were the first things that were pulling you away from, you know, the little enclave of school?
Well, I think part of it was also I worked off campus. Like I had a job. I was intersecting with people who weren't part of the RISD. But also, you know, there was underground venues that were still tied to the institution. I mean, there were kids who were going to RISD who were running these underground venues, but they were so far off campus that there was like no way for you to, you had to get, if you wanted to go, you had to get out of that neighborhood. And just from being in these spaces, I just feel like I ended up making a lot of friends who weren't students. So I think that was part of it, is just my social sphere was outside of just being students.
And at what point does music enter the picture for you? Because of course, you know, not just sound and performance art that includes sound, but also music, playing in bands and playing shows and releasing records and going on tour. This has been a huge part of your life as an artist. So where did that really begin for you? Did you start playing in bands when you were in school, or?
You know, like right at the end, I was dating someone who was like, you know, local legend kind of person set themselves on fire during a performance. And I was just really, I think I was just always attracted to extreme music and extreme forms of expression in that way. And he just really actually encouraged me. He was a bass player and encouraged me to play the bass. And I always thought, like, I was 21, but I thought I was too old. I thought I was too old to learn an instrument. And so from that, I was in my first band, and it was four women. There was one person who had been a drummer since she was a child. So like one really good musician. And then the rest of us were all just like, just figuring out as we went along. And that was a really great experience. And I think just feeling like we could do anything. But mm-hmm. even at that time, like I was so, what attracted me to music performance and was just the physicality of how people perform. And there's just so many just amazing drummers that were around at that time, specifically Adam Autry and Brian Chippendale, and just seeing these people who hit the drums so incredibly hard. And I mean, they're both incredibly technically proficient, but I feel like I wanted to feel that power almost of hitting something and then like that making the sound. And so I ended up getting this like real ragtag drum set and like teaching myself how to play the drums. Things just really started going from there.
I'm curious, you know, around that time, what kind of music were you listening to? Like, what were you absorbing? Not in terms of like formal genres, but just maybe, you know, yeah, what were you listening to and how is this manifesting out into the music you were making?
Yeah,
I know that like metal has been a huge part of, you know, what you do.
Yeah, I would say even at that time, like I wasn't even so involved in what was going on in metal in Providence. Mm-hmm. Like, Slayer's obviously a huge influence on me, although no one would ever know that from my music, but just, yeah, favorite metal band of all times. Isn't that everyone? No. People have other ideas about metal, sorry. At that time, I was really, like, more into things like Big Black, more, like, things that were post-punk, I guess. But, you know, as I started developing, I think I just wanted more extreme sounds, or so those sounds weren't quite doing it for me anymore, even though those are like beloved favorites. But also just what was going on locally was hugely formative. Just going to see other experimental musicians play. I mean, I remember seeing Zeke Sheck play at Fort Thunder, and it totally blew my mind. And like, I think actually really changed how I thought about music performance just because of the theatricality to what she was bringing to her music performances. So it was just a lot percolating at that time. And I'd say that I'm just such an avid music collector and just voracious in that. So what I've like collected or been influenced by since then has like really outside of that genre. I mean, Diamanda Galas is a huge influence. Just metal as a genre, just like the images, the culture is a huge influence on me. You know, something that was deeply influential to me was that Providence local bands were eccentric. They didn't necessarily fit into a genre, and we're just such a small city that there wasn't enough of any type of music for there to be these like genre groups, I would say. And so you got a lot of mixed bills, and that was like a really great thing to come of age around because I just had so many influences.
Yeah. So you mentioned that during your time at RISD, you were screen printing and you were seeing these posters. And I would imagine at a certain point you started to make your own, of course. So I'm curious if you could speak more to your relationship to, you know, screen printing and poster making for, again, this utilitarian purpose and becoming part of that kind of dialogue.
Yeah, I mean, that was the way you found out about things at that time. Like, it's hard to remember. Like, it's even easy for me to forget at this point. Like, the internet did exist, but not in the way that we use it now. I mean, obviously, the internet's changed so much the last 20 years, but just you would wake up in the morning and you'd go about your day and your job or whatever, and I would just like keep my eyes peeled for like what was posted up around town. And, you know, Providence just has amazing screen printers. And I think there is a little bit of competitiveness about it in a way where, you know, like the amount of work that someone put into a poster could almost show how much they were invested in it. Mm-hmm. And it made you be like, okay, this show is going to be sick. Because if this person, you know, made this 4-foot poster that they like screen printed on electric box, like they're obviously really invested in it. And you started to like know different people's styles and like who was printing what, but that was just, there was a magic to that of waking up in the morning. I mean, this is something I feel like I know Xander said, it's just like this like rush of like waking up and like wondering what happened in the night and seeing these like messages. And you know, like a lot of the posters, they weren't necessarily legible. So, you know, there was a certain point where at some point you might need to be in the know or like ask around, but it was a very different culture around events and underground events that, you know, you had to see things on the streets to just to know about them.
As a screen printer yourself, were there ever moments where you're looking at a poster and you're like, wait, how did they do that? And then you're trying to piece together the craft and the process?
Oh, totally. And just learning from people's choice of materials or colors. I mean, people got really wild here with like cutouts and like moving pieces. And obviously like that sort of thing is not going to work so well when it's like wheat pasted out. But yeah, I think there, yeah, I just really loved that time. And, you know, when we would do events at the Dirt Palace, you know, we would sort of pass off who was going to do the poster for which event, because there was so many great screen printers and artists who were here. And so you might sort of be like, well, these are bands that I really connect to, so I want to do the poster for this one. And I learned a lot at that time just about screen printing from having, you know, wanting to promote events and being invested in nightlife and wanting to make something that would make people come to an event. So yeah, I learned a lot during that time just from printing a lot of posters.
What you were saying about, you know, wanting to make the poster for the band that you really care about, that really resonates. And it's interesting. It's similar to how being an organizer of shows and like booking a show for a band that like you really love and wanting to make sure that there's an audience there. I can see how those go hand in hand.
Yeah, I feel like fandom is a huge part of my work. You know, like maybe it's not completely apparent on the surface, but I think I feel like I'm constantly referencing like my deep fan loves in my work, whether that be certain music tropes or horror elements or like just that like collection of samples or ideas. Like, yeah, I think. And so there became a time where people wanted me to make posters all the time. And I started becoming really selective. Like because I was putting so much energy into it. I'm a really slow worker too. So I just was like, I'm only going to make prints for projects that I'm like really passionate about. And so at some point I really petered off in like my production around posters. And I'd be like, man, I'll only make maybe one or two a year actually. Yeah. Cause I really wanted to, I mean, that was felt really important to me, is that like deep connection to what, and also a part of it's like I knew that afterwards that would be my memory. Mm-hmm. Like the poster would become like a stand-in for like the memories of the event. So really wanting to make something that documented the memory in some way, even though I hadn't had the memory yet, but sort of my idea of what that night might be like.
That's so beautiful. So music and sound for you, of course, extends well beyond your life of playing in various bands and touring all over. It's very much a part of your contemporary art practice when we look at the work that you're making today. So a recent body of work of yours in particular that I'm thinking of is The Sound of It Hammering Against the Skirts, which consists of a whole bunch of different facets, and performance and sound and sculptures and kinetic objects. So I was hoping you could take us through that body of work.
Sure. I think to talk about that body of work, I kind of need to back up. And like my progression of playing music was you know, I was a drummer, but I like really didn't want my drums to sound like drums anymore. I wanted there to be something more. Like I was just like, I wanted like maybe if I slammed my kick pedal, I wanted it to sound like a million birds taking off or something, or like my snare to sound like, yeah, I wanted the percussive sound of the snare, but maybe also like shrieking pigs. Like there's just another sort of way that I was like thinking about sound that I was just getting away from this like traditional rock instrumentation that was like really important to me. And I started doing that within playing the drums. But then at some point, being behind a drum kit was making it so that I couldn't actually perform the way that I wanted to do, because I was thinking a lot about my body and like how what I was doing would inform the story of what I was telling or what I was referring to. And so I did start making constructing different instruments. And part of that was like my drum set was completely, you know, like my kick drum was a 50 gallon oil drum that I had like modded with this like fan belt, and I was doing all these things of like experimenting with instrument building. But I wanted to get behind the drums, and because I was really maybe thinking more in a performance art context, I had a solo project called, well, I still have a solo project called Rectrix. And that's when I started I was already doing really performative things with Bone Dust, but really thinking about the whole performance and like what kind of story that told. And as someone who had also done a fair amount of installation artwork, wanting to build an environment where I was performing that could really, you know, give that suspension of disbelief and like pull an audience through me, of not feeling like they were watching someone on stage performing music. So the sound of it hammering against the skirts was actually tying together, it was a bigger performance, tying together six different songs that I had created, but each song was in a different vignette within the space. So the audience sort of traveled with me through this installation throughout the space. And each song had different props or sculptural objects or different performers involved. The sound of it hammering against the skirts was actually the final song of that performance. So I titled it for the entire piece. In that performance at the end, I had already been collecting these bells that were shaped like women for several years. And it was one of those things like, you know, I don't know if you ever had a collection of things where once people know you're collecting a thing, they just start giving them to you. So I had been collecting these bells shaped like women, just like really fascinated with them. Like this idea of like the skirt being this resonance was just so beautiful to me. And I, in this performance, I use the bells, and I have been collaborating for many years on and off with Chrissy Walpert. We were in this band called Bone Dust together, and Chrissy also, founded the Assembly of Light Choir, which is a community choir in Providence, that she would compose music for, but also did a lot of performance things with the body. We also used the choir or members from the choir to do other performances. And in this project, members of the choir were in the audience. And so as I like passed a bell to one performer, Rebecca Mitchell, she started ringing the bell, singing the note of the bell. And then gradually each member of the choir came out of the audience, and the audience is all around. I mean, there's not a stage, so we're all interspersed with each other, taking bells off the table and ringing them and singing the note of that particular bell. And so you can imagine none of the bells are tuned to each other. It's like just this dissonant drone of voices and like clanging metal.
Thank you.
And then the performer, Renee Green, and I sang a song over the top of that piece. And I think that's something that when I'm performing, it's really important to me that it's maybe like less about what the audience might receive from a piece. Is like, I'm like really chasing some sort of, like, I call it ecstatic abandon, where when I'm performing, I get to like totally, it's like an altering of senses or like losing of myself. And that's like not necessarily has anything to do with what the work is about or what I'm referencing or lyrically or thinking about conceptually, but just as a performer, that's like what keeps me wanting to perform is this just, all I can really say is ecstatic abandon. It's like my favorite feeling of the world in the world where, and just being able to be singing over this otherworldly sound of these, like all these voices in dissonance and these like bells ringing together was just a really powerful experience for me. Which is like, something that is just, very maybe disconnected from what an audience might get from that moment, or it's like chasing a feeling. And I think trying to chase that feeling has been part of why I've like wanted to like lose the constraints of like a traditional instrument or something, because that would bring me back into reality. And so being able to have like whatever my body is doing, like deeply connected to the sound, it's been part of like a, I guess, path that I've been on.
Yeah. And I would imagine being seated behind a drum set on a stage.
Yeah.
Maybe it has more of those trappings of audience, performer. I'm here to perform to you in a way that maybe it's harder to achieve that.
Yeah. And having that experience with those, that choir, I mean, it's just like a, you know, a collective experience that we had together. And that also, was something that I had been interested in, but like, yeah, thinking less about maybe the audience and like my own experience of where I'm going through while I'm making the work and how that might also change my thinking.
So when you were initially talking about your kind of like impulse to set aside the drums or the desire to have a different sound come out of it, you know, the sound, you sort of a flock of birds, or initially I was surprised because, you know, having experienced your drumming live, it's just so powerful, you know, it has so much force to it. It's one of those things that it seems like you were just like really meant to do. But now seeing what you're doing in this like new extension of performative sound and handcrafted objects, it kind of all makes sense because it's kind of even more powerful and more extreme in a way. And I'm thinking specifically of an object that's actually sitting right next to you here that was part of this body of work, this axe that you turned into a MIDI controller and became part of a performance. I was hoping you could maybe share a bit about that.
Yeah. So the axe, I'm like, do you want to see the axe?
Yeah.
Yeah. So the axe, so the axe is basically programmed with an accelerometer so that when it doesn't know when it hits contact with something, but I'm talking about the programming as if it's knowledge, but this is how I like to think about it. It's like my embodied axe. It knows. So when it doesn't know when it hits something, but it knows when it's gone on a downward axis and it's stopped and it triggers a MIDI signal. That then triggers a sample on my sampler. And I think that was like part of the progression was when you were saying like my drums, like it seemed like something I was meant to do, is I was actually doing a lot of sound manipulation. Like my drums had their own like speaker system. Mm-hmm. I was already triggering samples in that context because I was like, they don't sound big enough. Like I just wanted them to sound huge. Yeah. Or also it's like a little bit of amplifier worship where I just wanted them to be so crushingly loud. Mm-hmm. So with the axe, I think part of like where my process ended up going was I got really into thinking about what sound design, and actually a lot of my music is actually sample based. And I am constantly scouring like movies, especially horror genre movies, or like other instruments or other musicians' work to like really create sound. And like part of that was coming from, I was really thinking about at the time this like pretensions of metal culture, of like pretensions of evil, like within the culture of like how people present themselves, because they're like playing this really aggressive and violent music, but within that it's like pretty traditional instrumentation. And like thinking about all of the like horror imagery that is in with metal, it is like in some ways like very alienating when you think about horror genre, which I'm like a huge fan of, but within horror genre, contextually, most of the time, like my body is like the body of the victim, or like what violence is being acted upon. And so I was like really thinking about like, I mean, it's a real conflict in with me. It's like, I have these like really passionate loves that are like sometimes at odds with my political beliefs, and like how to like be invested in this music that's maybe portraying a certain amount of violence, but then thinking about violence and like my relation to it. And as a, like someone who is a victim of violence. So really taking those sounds and like thinking about horror and really trying to use horror sounds. I mean, I was really influenced by, Exorcist, the artist who did the sound design, Ron Nagel, where it's like layering like bees and like barking dogs, like started like layering bees over the sounds of guitars, or just like these sounds that would like make people feel more uncomfortable. And so from that, it's like the axe, I was like, well, I could create a song or music from like just sourced imagery, I mean, sourced sounds. And so with the axe, what I did was, I actually, this is like kind of a long performance where I was buried. Someone buried me in dirt, and I was sampling, there's that part in Possession where Isabella Gianni is just totally losing her like psychological space, that, and it's almost like an interior monologue for me, not for her. She was like unhinged. And then, the same person who was burying me dumps a bucket of water to like, sort of like wake me up. And I sang this song, by Simon Diaz, La Tonada de la Luna Llena, which is like the song of the full moon. And then I grabbed the axe and started destroying the structure that I had been buried upon. And so the axe became the instrument that was like triggering this sound for the song. But then I was also like destroying something at the same time.
So, sort of part of this whole body of work. Also, I know that you produced this artist book that's simultaneously a book. It's an object, but it also contains both a musical score, and we've been talking a bit about it. So I don't know if you would perhaps consider a score for your performance art, but it is in some way. But it also reads as fiction.
Yeah, I think when I was writing those performance scripts, it was almost like my imagination about what happens within the performance, within also in the context of what is actually happening. So there is like a fictional writing to it. I'm like pretty, I mean, the fact that we're video documenting this conversation is like an ease of mine, just because like I want to like live in the memory of the action. And sometimes the documentation, you can be like, oh, my memory is not really how it happened. But I'm really interested in this like friction between the memory of an event and all of the things, your associations of how, and your reference points and what it's making you think about with the actual event. And that was something that even just within that body of work was how I started creating the sculptures that were connected to the songbook, mm-hmm. was that I was thinking a lot about how to have sculptural stand-ins for the bodies that were present within the work, like during the performance. I feel like there's just like a piece that I made. It felt like such an outlier at the time. It was like not connected to anything I'd ever made. But the Dirt Palace did this show at Harvard where they wanted us to create a timeline of the Dirt Palace, a history of the Dirt Palace, which is something that, like, this is sort of a crazy tangent, but, We just never wanted to do a timeline before because it just felt like Xander and I, as founders of the Dirt Palace, there was like too much authority in us being the people who would tell the story. We knew that that would be just our history, and that, you know, the history is everyone who's ever been here. So as part of that exhibition, we created a timeline by making every person who had ever been involved in the Dirt Palace at point got a peephole into a wall. And so, you know, it's like under the umbrella concept that we've used before, like the secret rooms of the Dirt Palace. So there is this wall with like hundreds of peepholes in it. And some of the peepholes are going to like maybe someone's individual artwork, like a slide image. And other ones are like bigger where you're looking into like a diorama. And then some other people made videos where you're like looking into the wall and you can watch a video and there's sound. And there are all these like eyes. You're like looking into the eyes of these peepholes. And for that work, my like diorama was that I had built inside the wall was like an ode to the days of the Dirt Palace where we had a really bad leak and like the roof just leaked all the time. And something like Xander and I used to say was that we were like connected to the building in this way where like we would wake up in the middle of the night because we knew that the garbage can that was filling with water needed to be emptied before it started overflowing, and this sort of like being in tune with the building. And so, I mean, there was a lot going on inside this box, but part of it was that I had like this drip of water going through the diorama that was slowly splashing. It was a mirrored box, so you could see like infinity of all the images that I had inside there, but was reconstituting these discarded contact lenses that had been collecting over the course of a long time. But I was just thinking about this, like the first time that I made a piece where there was like motion in it, like a sculpture where there was like this dripping of the water, and like how that connected to like the memory and like how it connected to time, you know, like there was like this thing that we all experienced and it was like a lived experience. And that was like almost 10 years ago at this point, but I feel like I've just been thinking about that work for so long. And that's kind of like what has pulled me to like where I am now, where I'm making these kinetic sculptures, is just like part of like thinking a lot about like being a body and how that's connected to being in time, you know, like so I have like a lot of like hangups around time. And my partner, like he gave me the slim reader of Heidegger, Being in Time. And that like really crushed me in this way that was almost incapacitating, because it was the first time I heard, like, thought of the concept of like when you think you don't have enough time, it's like you're like running to the future self of yourself, looking back at yourself and just being disappointed at your like concept of who you were. Like this, like it's actually not that you don't have enough time. It's that you're not happy with your concept of self. Mm. And that was like really crushing to me. But the first time I started thinking of like time as being centered in your body or yourself. And then he also gave me a slim reading from the egoist philosopher, Dora Martson. And her writing is about how time is really like motion, measured motion. But thinking about that in the terms of like the blood coursing through your veins is like motion, or like your breath is motion. And just what she says in this book is that like we are time, but we're also the measuring piece. And like that sort of feeling to me of thinking about memories is just when I started really naturally gravitating to making kinetic work, because I felt like there needed to be a time-based element to the work to like ground it into like being human or being a body in this way that was like connected to those ideas that were floating around.
Yeah. Well, and also the book containing the musical score and this kind of like very poetic performance score, in a way I can see how it's like a controlled environment. It's a way of like forming that memory and binding it up. So one last theme, or I think common thread in your work that's come up a few times that I was curious to just hear your thoughts about is, you know, I think in everything from your music that I've experienced over the years to your visual art, there is this kind of like haunted nature to things. And your most recent Kinetic sculpture that you shared with us feels like a really tangible, like palpable manifestation of that. So I'm curious if that's something you could speak to.
Yeah, it's interesting. I've only started using that word recently, and it feels really at odds with, like, I know every time someone comes to the Wedding Cake House, they're like, is it haunted? And I'm like, I am so much of a non-believer. I don't even believe in reality. I don't know what you guys are talking about. There's no hauntings here. But I think a lot of what is like coursing through my work is a certain, like, I think a lot of what I'm wrestling with is like maybe this like antiquated ideal of art where I'm actually thinking about emotion and like affect. And that's almost like the material of what I'm working with. And I think a lot of that is related to memory and experience. And like, I think there's like a haunting nature to thinking about or reliving memories, maybe. That's like not thinking about memories, but actually I think being in a state where you like relive them, which is maybe not a healthy position to be in, but in thinking about like ways of navigating different forms of grief, I think that is like a common aspect of people just like reliving things. And so I think that's probably how the haunted nature comes about. Mm. Yeah.
Yeah. I can, when you recontextualize the word, you know, I said probably said the exact same thing when I first walked into Wedding Cake House, you know.
Sorry,
I
didn't
mean, No. But it's interesting because thinking about the word in the context of your work versus like, yeah, this like common vernacular sense, it's those are such two different things. Yeah, that makes total sense. Well, Pippi, thank you again so much for taking the time to sit down and chat today. This was a real treat.
Yeah, thank you so much. I learned a lot from the conversation. Yeah.
Great.
And thank you, dear listener. As always, if you like what you're hearing on the show, listener support is hugely important to making it all happen. You can always join us over at patreon.com/artobsolescence, or if you are interested in just making a one-time tax-deductible gift through our fiscal sponsor, the New York Foundation for the Arts, you can do so at artandobsolescence.com/donate. And there you can also find the full episode archive, including full transcripts and show notes, all of that good stuff. And last but not least, you can always find us on social media at Art Obsolescence. Until next time, take care, my friends. My name is Cass Fina Radden, and this has been Art and Obsolescence.